Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And coming right up, we've got the Old Mole Variety Hour featuring Norm Diamond as the host today. And at 10 o'clock, Dr. David Naiman hosts Health Watch. He'll interview naturopathic physicians Dr. Kimberly Winstar and Dr. Steven Sandberg-Lewis on natural approaches to cardiovascular health. And at 10:30 on Earthwatch, Chris Andre interviews Tyson Slocum, an expert on oil company profits and the windfall profits tax, about the ExxonMobil 2005 earnings report just out today. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, hear an hour-long interview with Harry Belafonte. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media, and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Tammy already told you that. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. You're listening to KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond. I'm hosting this morning. Tammy Dean is our engineer. We often begin the program by building on the metaphor of the old mole. Underground, getting at the roots of social phenomena, active undermining. Friend Michelle did a brilliant piece a few weeks ago in which she traced the old mole image through Marx, Hegel, and back to Shakespeare, then connected it through the mole as digger to the workplace safety issues that were dominating the news then and seemed to have been forgotten as soon as the West Virginia miners were buried. Tom Becker has begun programs he's hosted by uncovering Nietzsche's identification of himself as mole, laboring in the dark, but with confidence he will contribute to a coming rosy dawn. Today is the last time I'll host the old mole. I'd like to put aside the rich and evocative metaphor for a moment and say directly how I see the perspective of the Old Mole Variety Hour, what it offers, what it tries to accomplish. First and foremost, the Old Mole group sees ourselves and our listeners as active participants in shaping our lives and our society. It's never been enough for this program to do exposés showing the large, sometimes horrible forces at work out there and what's being done to people. Whether we're looking at government policies or the maneuvers of international capital or the consequences of new technologies, we've made it a point always to dig for the ways people resist and influence those forces. More, we celebrate the ways that even within the shell of the old, people create alternatives, whether in our daily lives and relationships or in intentionally alternative institutions and organizations. We treat ourselves and you, our audience, as the subjects of our own stories and not just the objects. We treat you and ourselves as potentially even more active than we are at present. Even while we're celebrating resistance and alternatives, we try to suggest criteria for which kinds of resistance, which of our alternative creations, actually have the potential to make things better. When we look at history, as we shall today, our perspective is that things change, that they're always changing, and that outcomes aren't fixed, but depend partly on our own efforts and those of the people like us who were alive and struggling in whatever epoch. Things could have been different. We can learn from that past to better influence outcomes in the future. When we examine culture, as we also shall today, we see it both as a manifestation of people's creativity and as part of the struggle to shape our sense of our own capability to join with others and to make a difference. When we look at current events, something it won't surprise you to learn we'll also do in today's program, we go beyond the news of the moment to find the seeds of the future. In all this, we find opportunities, and hope. Our efforts aim at buoying your spirits and ours. I hope, in the 9 years I've been part of this program, I've been able to contribute to that hopefulness. On today's program, Bill Resnick will talk with Roan Carey, author of The New Intifada. Larry Bolden will review Empire Falls, a novel turned into a TV program by Richard Russo. And Brooke Jacobson and Wiley Barnett will introduce this year's African Film Festival. Let's begin, though, with more culture, more history, and more exploration of the Old Mole perspective. A few years ago, a friend and I wanted to use a poem by Bertolt Brecht in a book we were writing. The poem is usually called A Worker Reads History, which already is not a very good translation from the original. We contacted the Brecht estate, spoke with their agent, appealed to Brecht's son, to his daughter, but they wouldn't give permission to use a new and improved translation. So as one of my last Old Mole acts, I'd like to present the new and illegal version of the Brecht poem. Our title, and this is a translation that I did with Sylvia Hart Landsberg, we call it, and this is much closer to the German original, Questions of a Worker While Reading. Here's the poem. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? Books answer with the names of kings. Did the kings haul in the boulders? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who rebuilt it every time? In which houses of golden Lima lived the women and men who built it? In the evening, when the Chinese wall was finished, where did the masons go? Great Rome is full of triumphal arches. Who erected them? Over whom did the Caesars triumph? Had the greatly celebrated Byzantium only palaces for its inhabitants? Even in legendary Atlantis, as the sea devoured it, the drowning ones in the night bellowed for their slaves. Young Alexander conquered India. He alone? Caesar beat the Gauls. Was there not at least a cook with him? Philip of Spain wept as his fleet was wrecked. Did no one else weep? Frederick II triumphed in the Seven Years' War. Aside from him, who triumphed? On every page of victory, who cooked the victory feast? Every 10 years, a great man. Who paid the costs? So much information. So many questions. Now, in that book, The Power in Our Hands, that Bill Bigelow and I wrote, where we used that poem, we ask the reader to go further than the poem itself does, not only to realize that ordinary people are behind the great historical events. We wanted to be able to see the ordinary people behind the clothing and the food and the electronic products that we encounter. We wanted to see the human effort that creates those products and learn to see the work conditions and work process as something that's a part of the product itself. But there are other ways to go beyond the Brecht poem. I'd like to play you a song that does so quite wonderfully. It's from my all-time favorite rock opera, Seattle 1919, based on the general strike that took place in Seattle that year. I was visiting my son at his college just a few months ago and found, by quite an amazing coincidence, that his faculty advisor in the sociology department was the main author and composer of this entire album that I had treasured for years. Rob Rosenthal, I hope you're listening out there in Connecticut. From Seattle 1919, here's Street Speech, a soapbox oration by Anna Louise Strong, building toward the extraordinary general strike.
They say the pharaohs built the pyramids. Do you think one pharaoh dropped one bead of sweat. We built the pyramids for the pharaohs, and we're building for them yet. Oh, my sisters, oh, my brothers, we've been building for these others. I think it's time we kept it for ourselves. We don't want them, we don't need them. These parasites who live off someone else. Better turn it around, take another look. Forget what they made you read in your history books. Brick by brick, name by name, we built their mansion and we built the jail.
I like that song. We've been listening to Street Speech. That's part of the album Seattle 1919. The group that's performing it is called The Fuse. I hope you actually go out and get a copy for yourself. Street Speech, that song, makes explicit what's only implicit in the Brecht poem that I read before. It's not only past history, but in our own times, that the actions of ordinary people underlie events and make things happen. That as long as we're only behind the scenes, we're kept divided. That we have the capacity to shape events in ways that suit our own needs and interests. Anna Louise Strong could have been giving that speech on this very day, January 30th, in 1919. Next week, February 6th, at 10 a.m., the precise minute the Old Mole Variety Hour ends, is the anniversary of the beginning of the Seattle General Strike. There are all kinds of historic passages that comment on how the city went absolutely silent at 10 a.m. on February 6th. The strike is special in U.S. history for the tremendous solidarity across competing unions There were, as I remember, something like 140 different unions, ranging from some of the stodgiest craft unions all the way across to the Wobblies, and complete solidarity among them at the beginning of the strike and in the course of the strike, solidarity across ethnic groups. In Seattle, of course, that means Asian groups. And solidarity internationally. This is 1919, after all. There are revolutions happening all over. And one of the issues in Seattle becomes whether arms will be loaded to send to counter-revolutionary forces, especially attacking the new revolution in Russia. The Seattle general strike also posed the problem that every general strike raises: how to maintain vital functions like health care and food supply when the normal authority structures are prevented from operating. In Seattle, the workers simply took over and ran things as they'd been capable, and as we are too. And they did it well. This is very reminiscent also of what happened in Oakland in the general strike after World War II. Here, just for the fun of it, I'd like to play you a further track from Seattle 1919 that highlights this facet of the strike. This one's called "Nothing Moves But the Tide," from Seattle, 1919.
I was born at Saturday Bridge. I grew up in the Cobra States. The daddy ran a tavern there, up by Pistol Bay. And I heard the miners talking about a new world that was coming. And I believe I'd see that new world coming today. He said, "Boy, you listen closely. There's a secret that we know. They won't teach you this in schoolhouse. They won't tell you.
Without our say-so, nothing moves but the tide. As Tammy just said, this music makes the concepts real. It's wonderful music, and the concepts, of course, I've chosen today because I've been talking a little bit about the kind of perspective that this entire program tries to communicate. To carry on, we've got Bill Resnick with Roan Carey, author of The New Intifada.
Thank you, Norm, and thank you for all your work on The Old Mole. The last piece was typical and wonderful. Thank you very much. Roan Carey, editor of The Nation, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. It's good to be on.
Roan Carey is working now as managing editor of The Nation, I believe. I looked at the masthead, interim managing editor. He's an author, editor of several books, The New Intifada and Israel Voices of Dissent. Roan Carey, both in Israel and Palestine, the political worlds have radically changed over the past months, especially with Hamas's extraordinary victory in last week's parliamentary elections. Tell us about the changes in both countries.
Well, I think everyone now is concentrating on what's happened with the Palestinian elections and Hamas's victory, which is indeed a truly stunning change of direction. A lot of people are shocked by it, but people shouldn't have been. The Palestinian people have indicated how distraught and how angry they've been over corruption and incompetent government by the Palestinian Authority. And now they've been given a chance to vote democratically for an alternative. So much of this is a kind of a sentiment that's very common in America, which is basically throw the bums out, give the alternative a chance. Now, a lot of people are concentrating on what the Hamas charter says and the fact that in their charter they insist that all of British Mandate Palestine is an Islamic trust and that the state of Israel has no right to exist and so forth and so on, which is true, that is in the charter, but the Palestinian people voted for Hamas not because they are wedded to the ideas in that charter. In fact, polls repeatedly show that the Palestinian people are overwhelmingly willing to settle for a two-state solution with East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine and Israel behind the 1967 borders. What they really were voting for was not that ideological edge to Hamas, but the fact that Hamas has been governing where they have governed in municipalities honestly and efficiently, without corruption, without stealing money. And so that's really what this election, the real significance of it,
mm-hmm.
is. Now, on the Israeli, I can talk a bit about the Israeli side.
And in the election, Hamas showed, who knows what it means, undoubtedly part of the party, actually, a quite moderate face. In fact, having women running for the parliament, having Christians on their ticket, this is not a radical Islamist party, it seems to me, in at least in the terms of they're understood in the Middle East.
Well, there are different elements in it. I think it's a huge mistake to lump Hamas in with, for example, Al Qaeda or with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Al Qaeda Mesopotamia guerrilla unit that's fighting the Americans in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a nationalist movement. Yes, it's Islamist. Yes, they have certain what we on the left and liberal side of things would consider reactionary attitudes about women, about society. From the perspective of the left, the overall religious framework with which Hamas looks at politics is not something that we would applaud. On the other hand, you put it correctly, yes, they see themselves overwhelmingly as being responsible for the national movement of Palestinians, and they also have always wanted to work with other Palestinians, not to engage in a frontal assault. They've cooperated with the PFLP, which is the Marxist Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. They have had very close cooperation with members of Fatah at the lower levels, people who are not corrupt, people who they know have the respect of the population. For example, Marwan Barghouti, Hamas. Marwan Barghouti is one of the most popular Fatah leaders in the West Bank precisely because he's not corrupt. He's been sentenced to 5 life terms by Israel for engaging in acts of violence. Hamas has worked closely with Barghouti in trying to coordinate a sort of all-Palestinian response to how they deal with the occupation. So, and in other terms, they have shown moderation. They've had, they've agreed to a basically a truce, which they have consistently and very determinedly held to over the last year. They've been much more consistent and disciplined in having a ceasefire with Israel than Fatah ever was. So in some respects, the Hamas victory is not something for Israelis to be as shocked by as some have been.
Mm-hmm. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Roan Carey, who wrote, edited the New Intifada and Israel Voices of Dissent. We've been talking about the Hamas victory in the Palestinian parliamentary elections. Roan Carey, we really have to get into the remarkable quality of the elections. A model for the United States, in fact, as our elections become more and more corrupt. But let before we get into that, and for the Middle East, let's talk about their reception in Israel, and in fact the changes in Israeli politics over the last 6 months, which have been also pretty remarkable in some ways, although overshadowed by Hamas's victory.
It's true. It's been pretty momentous what's happened in Israel. I mean, obviously everyone remembers the disengagement from Gaza last summer. That was a huge move by Ariel Sharon, and in some ways he went back on a project that had been very dear to him for the last 30 years, which was to build as many settlements as possible. And he finally realized a couple of years ago that this was not workable, that there was no way that Israel could build settlements anywhere and everywhere, because it endangered the Zionism, because basically it would mean that eventually Israel is overwhelmed by more Palestinians than there are Jewish Israelis. So he withdrew from Gaza. At the same time, there's been a kind of rebellion inside the Labor Party, and I think much to the hope of a lot of people, liberals in the left. It's the new leader of the Labor Party, Amir Peretz, is very much a working class tribune. He's fought consistently for improved minimum wages, for better working conditions, for an end to the neoliberal policies first put forth by Benjamin Netanyahu that have led to the greatest disparity in wealth of any nation, of any industrialized nation, is now Israel has the greatest disparity of wealth of any industrialized Western nation, which is a huge change from the way things were even 15, 20 years
really?
Ago.
Greater than the United States and Brazil?
Yeah.
Even? My
yeah,
goodness, that's an accomplishment.
Well, see, you know, Israel, it's especially shocking because Israel was, I mean, set aside for a moment how they've treated Palestinians, but for the Jewish population, Israel was always pretty much a good welfare state. You know, there was much more equality than most Western nations. But just in the last 10 or 15 years, the bottom has dropped out. Poverty has increased radically. Just about a third of the population, I think a little bit less than a third of the population, is under the poverty line. And all of this has to do with huge budget cuts. And Amir Peretz taking over the Labor Party is really a popular reaction to this extremely brutal capitalist change that's come over Israel. So that's something to hope for. I mean, mm-hmm. polls show that he doesn't have much of a chance in the upcoming elections in March, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that security issues and dealing with the Palestinians has overshadowed social and economic issues at home. But it is a sign of hope in Israel that there is now that the Labor Party actually represents labor, lowercase l, labor, and the working class, as opposed to, you know, militarist Zionists, people like Ehud Barak, or at least elements of it. I shouldn't say it's controlled now by people like Peretz, but at least he has, people like Peretz have much more influence mm-hmm. than they did earlier.
You talked, that Sharon had to give up his project, and the sort of the Greater Israel project. It seems to me, though, he substituted it for it a cleverer scheme, unfortunately, which was to unilaterally withdraw from some areas of the West Bank while building his wall and basically expanding Israel into the much, much further into the West Bank and further cutting off and cantonizing or bantustanizing the Palestinian areas of the West Bank. It seems to me that project is going on really successfully, unfortunately. And they're using the victory of Hamas to cement international support for that project.
Well, that's true. Ehud Olmert, who's the new head of the party that Sharon created when he broke away from Likud a couple of months ago, he created this new party, Kadima, which was basically supposed to be a creature of Sharon and allow him to escape from the rejectionist backbenchers in Likud, and now it's been taken over by Olmert, with Sharon's being in a coma. The election, the victory of Hamas has allowed the right and Israel to say, to say, oh God, now they want to kill us all, you know, we can't give up any settlements. But it's also, I think it's convinced others that there still may be a need for with further withdrawals. It's true. Sharon's goal was to shuck off Gaza, control it from the outside, make it so that Israel would not be responsible for the population, and meanwhile absorb anywhere from 20 to 40 to 50% of the West Bank, just unilaterally annex it. And what we've seen, the Hamas victory is basically the result of what we've had more than 10 years of, we've had several years of unilateral Israeli ways of dealing with the Palestinian situation, refusal to negotiate, refusal to actually sit down and talk about how two states could be formed. And so unilateralism from the Israeli side has
and the killing of Palestinian leadership or jailing, whatever they want to do.
Assassination, I mean, arrests.
Yeah. And the sort of the daily humiliations that they impose on the Palestinian people, thinking that somehow you can humiliate them into submission. It seems to me that the people running Israeli politics, and there's a whole, they obviously represent different groups and parts of the military and the Mossad. Some of them really do come close to a sort of fascist mentalities.
Well, there is that element.
I don't want to say fascist, it's dangerous to say it, but some of them have that sort of view of how you control a people that you're occupying and you think are inferior. I mean, they're truly racist as well.
Well, it's an old tradition that goes back to the revisionist movement and Vladimir Jabotinsky. You know, it's called the Iron Wall, which is basically we can never really negotiate with the Arabs. We have to crush them. We have to defeat them. We have to show them that we're the masters, and then they will accept our terms. That's a really old mentality in Israel. It goes back to the first days of settlement a century ago, and it's still reflected in much of the leadership. That's Sharonism, and it's also the attitude in much of the Labor Party. And what they've done is this unilateral approach, this belief that you can just bash the Palestinians into submission, has created a mirror image, which is Hamas saying, well, look, the Fatah leadership and Yasser Arafat tried to convince our people 10 years ago that the path of negotiation is the way to go, that we should agree to recognize Israel, that we should agree to end all violence, that the only peaceful negotiation is the way to get our state. We promise you, the Palestinian people, that if we do this, you will get your state. Now, what happened? Over 7 years during the Oslo period, settlements expanded. They almost doubled. So the Palestinian people are completely disillusioned with this approach that basically they should give up, they should, you know, basically surrender and hope that the Israelis give to them what they see as their just reward. So that's why they've turned to Hamas. They said, look, the Oslo framework doesn't work. You know, if we concede everything at first and hope that the Israelis and the Americans give it to us, we're not going to get anything. And so the Hamas approach is saying, okay, no, we're not going to recognize Israel. If you want to talk about recognizing Palestine, if you want to talk about withdrawing behind the 67 lines as international law requires, then we can talk about a long-term truce. So that's sort of the terms by which Hamas now wants to approach the Israelis. Mm-hmm. They're not going to concede anything at first, but they're willing to come to terms if the terms are, if the terms are genuinely mutual.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Roan Carey. Roan, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left. It seems to me there are terrible possibilities, but then there are quite decent and even radically democratic possibilities, all of them present in the current moment. The good ones are, of course, quite fairly remote, but it seems to me not impossible. Maybe we could run through them fairly briefly. I mean, one horrible possibility is the U.S. neocons and the Israeli right continuing their process of not only destroying Hamas, but seeing this as an opportunity to go into Iran and to continue their crusade in the Middle East. And, of course, the Iranians may consider this a great opportunity to increase their influence and use Hamas as their tool for upsetting, for keeping the U.S. occupied there in Israel. What are the possibilities for Hamas actually running an honest administration and moving democratically within Palestine and for some kind of peace bloc to rise in Israel?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we should be cautious about predicting what's going to happen in the future. We don't really know. So far, Hamas has, for the most part, been able to stand outside of government and criticize it. But if you look at what they've done, if you look at the social service and welfare organizations that they've controlled over huge parts of the occupied territories, if you look at the municipalities where Hamas mayors have been elected, the record is pretty clear. They've been honest government, open government, responsive to the needs of the people. They've been efficient. They haven't been corrupt. And all that bodes pretty well. And again, we have to emphasize to our listeners, their big goal now is to reform internal Palestinian government, to make the government more responsive to the needs of the people. Very kind of, mundane things like building roads, building schools, making sure people are fed, clothed, housed. I mean, all the things that people look to government to do. They really are responding to this yearning on the part of the Palestinians that government should provide this. And so I think it's hopeful. I think another hopeful thing about this is that, we just saw the most democratic, by far, elections that have ever occurred anywhere in the Arab world, with the possible exception of Lebanon in some cases. So this is something that's worth celebrating. Sure, we don't like Hamas's ideology. We shouldn't have any illusions about some of the things they've said have been truly awful. I mean, in their original charter, for example, they applaud the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and they talk about how the Elks Club and the Rotary Club and whatnot are involved in a giant conspiracy. So there's some absurdities and a lot of bigotry at the heart of some of Hamas's ideology. But in terms of their pragmatic politics and their day-to-day politics and what they plan to actually do on the ground, they've been pretty efficient. And also they've shown repeatedly, their leaders have shown the ability to distinguish from they've said that a lot of the stuff in that charter is something that they can kind of set aside, that their main goal is to have a truce. And essentially, if not formally, practically speaking, they've all but recognized the two-state solution as the only practical solution.
Yeah. Ron Carey, thanks a lot for talking to us. So we'll continue this discussion over the next several months. Thank you very much.
It was great to be on the show, Bill.
Right, so long.
And thanks to both of you, Bill, and to Ron Carey of The Nation. Over the years, I've geared my reading list to Larry Bolden's recommendations. Here's Larry with a review of Richard Russo's Empire Falls.
I've often said that there are too many great or very good books to spend much time talking about bad or not very good ones. But today I want to talk about a not especially good book that is currently enjoying its moment of fame. The title of the book is Empire Falls, and its moment of fame is due, I think, primarily to its appearance as an HBO miniseries with an impressive cast including Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward, Helen Hunt, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Aidan Quinn, Ed Harris, and others. The series and or its actors have been nominated for a number of Golden Globe Awards, and I can understand the appeal of both the book and the series quite apart from the impressive cast. I openly applaud many of the messages in the book. I'll not say much here about the miniseries, except to urge readers to try the book before the film series. Richard Russo is a fine writer. He's funny and clever, and I think he may understand some of the glaring weaknesses of men as spouses, parents, friends, about as well as any male author I can think of. His male lead characters in Straight Man, Nobody's Fool, and The Risk Pool are drawn in clearly sympathetic ways, and yet Each of the men seems to seem simply befuddled by his spouse or lover. Each is apparently loving, but unable to really communicate or even to open up lines of communication with his loved ones. And although in some ways socially or politically astute, each seems unable to really take themselves seriously or do anything with their awareness. There are, as I recall, also very strong women characters in each of these books, and Rousseau is able to make it clear that he genuinely admires them as spouses, as parents, as people who do take themselves seriously in the world. And his male characters always seem to hope, in vain, to learn something from these exemplary women. Miles Roby, the lead character in Empire Falls, is just such a man, and I suppose that one of the things that almost immediately irritated me about the book was the similarity between Miles and all Rousseau's other well-meaning but obtuse male leads. Miles is separated from his wife, whom he seems not to understand at all. He is a caring and even diligent father to his teenage daughter, but generally it seems that it is she who must take care of him. His father, a much worse husband, communicator, parent, or serious person in the world than Miles, seems in most ways simply one of the male characters from an earlier Rousseau novel, grown into the pessimistic and ineffectual old man he was destined all along to become. Miles' mother, beautiful, wise, and self-sacrificing, seems also to be a reincarnation of one of Rousseau's earlier female characters. Whatever his father lacks in seriousness and self-discipline, his mother makes up for by seeming to have no life of her own at all. She is a mother, a wife, a provider, and she dies young, all seemingly ingredients in what Rousseau sees as the good woman. She has one glorious vacation on Martha's Vineyard, even a night or two of loving and being loved with a man whom the reader supposes she simply met there. And for this she pays and pays and pays. So having said so little good about the novel up to now, why would I review it or recommend it? Well, for one thing, it is a typical but important story to tell about how small towns, as well as big cities, often die at the mercy of the rich. A small factory town in Maine, Empire Falls flourishes for a generation or two due to the success of the shirt and textile factories that operate on the river. Almost everything in the town is owned by the same family who owns the factories, and when, through whim or boredom or less than expected financial returns, the last factory is closed down, it is the townspeople and not the owners who suffer. Many simply leave, forced to pull up stakes and find work somewhere else. Those who remain struggle simply to get by, their homes, just in case they own them, not worth much. But what else are they to do? And there's always the hope that the factory will come alive again. Miles runs a little restaurant, owned, of course, by Mrs. Whiting, the widow of the last in the line of Whitings, who have made their money by buying up whatever they saw and simply holding it as a hedge against the future. A literary type by nature, and the hope of his mother, who has sacrificed everything so that he can go to college and escape Empire Falls, Miles and his brother make a meager living running the restaurant. Miles left college and returned to Empire Falls due to his mother's cancer, and although he knows how much she would hate it, inertia and some sort of distorted loyalty keep him there even after she dies. Miles, too dispassionate even to be bitter, simply suffers his existence, buoyed at least slightly by his bright and wonderful daughter, who lives now with his estranged wife. While I would not call this book a political one, nevertheless it is distinctly blue-collar, and the sympathies of the author are obviously with the townspeople and not the wealthy owners. Indeed, we find eventually that the Whitings have simply been holding on to the land, the factory, the town, because they knew that some parts would eventually be attractive to outside money. And indeed, the factory is finally purchased by some corporation that specializes in buying and selling companies that have some valuable inventory, and in one way or another either turn a profit or serve as tax breaks. The hopes of the town are raised to a temporary ecstasy when the factory is purchased by outside money. The few who are now employed show that they can work for little, and then for less, in order to help increase profits. But alas, the comparatively small profits to be had have never been much of an issue with the owners, and when the time comes, the inventory, the equipment, is simply sold off, and the factory sold off because of the soon-to-be valuable riverfront land. The employees are let go without so much as a thought. And this is not out of malice or intent, but simply because of the necessary blindness of corporate greed. There's more to the book than I've mentioned. I find Rousseau's fascination with religion interesting. Miles, a Catholic by birth and then by a kind of devotion to his saintly dead mother, can neither embrace Catholicism nor completely abandon it. He paints the church for free while taking a skeptical role in arguments over theology with a new priest, and I'm convinced it is Rousseau who is doing the struggling, the questioning, wanting really to believe what he is quite sure is not true. I also like at least one of the women characters in the book, one whom I would say has occurred in other incarnations of Rousseau's novels. The woman, a few years older than Miles, has been his heartthrob since boyhood, although Miles seems unable to act on his infatuation in any way other than comparing her goodness to his wife's deficiencies. Most of all, Rousseau is a funny man, and he creates male characters that I like to laugh at, and whom I also encounter far too often in the mirror. Indeed, he seems to know quite a lot about these men, and even something about how they might rise up out of their passive existential despair and do something. Maybe in his next novel. I've been talking about Richard Rousseau's newest book, Empire Falls. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. Over the years, we've tried to come up with some sort of a mole metaphor nickname for the reviews that Larry does. I think the closest we ever got was the bookworm or something like that. We couldn't make it a mole. I've enjoyed, for all these years, the insights in Larry's reviews. One of the highlights of our cultural season is each year the African Film Festival. And here with Wiley Barnett is Brooke Jacobson to introduce us to this year's African Film Festival.
Thank you, Norm. And good morning, listeners. This is Brooke Jacobson, and I'm here, as Norm said, with Wiley G. Barnett, who is a very busy man these days, working as interim station manager and also a busy, busy member of the African Film Festival committee that puts on this annual event at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus. And last year they celebrated their 15th anniversary, so this is the 16th year and was expected to be a somewhat quieter year. However, they've been flooded with wonderful new films coming out of Africa. And and so it's starting this Friday night. And Wiley, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what people can look forward to this Friday night as the festival opens.
It's a delight to be with Ms. Jacobson, a longtime film reviewer and critic and a strong patron of the African Film Festival. We were really looking forward to this year, just as you mentioned. One of the interesting notes for the opening night is that we're going to be showing a film called The Hero, or in Portuguese, O Herói. We will begin and end the festival with films from Angola, which is very, very unusual because for a long, long time, the complete cinema industry had been closed down and films were not allowed to be made because of the political turmoil in the country. But this film is kind of a reflection of some of the times that people have experienced in Angola, and it starts off with a story about post-war Angola, and the first film features an army veteran named Victorio, and in order to obtain and hold on to a prosthetic leg so that he can secure a livelihood, he encounters this young orphan who is at the edge of either slipping into a life on the streets or will bring Victoria further source of renewal. Very interesting film. I saw it about a year or so ago myself, and I was enthralled, and I know everybody will be, not only because the story itself is very catching, but it was an excellent film filming.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this film will be, as we often do for our opening film, at the McMenamin Kennedy School, which is 5736 Northeast 33rd. And we tend to do that when we're expecting super large crowds, which we're kind of expecting it may be about 450 this year. But luckily, we'll have three showings. There will be one at 5 o'clock, one at 6 p.m., and one at 9 p.m. And because it's at McMenamin's Kennedy School, families that have youngsters and so forth will be able to attend the 5 and the 7 p.m. showings, but after 9, McMenamin's rule is that it's not underage.
Right, you have to be over 21.
You have to be over 21.
After 9 o'clock at McMenamin. So, but it's wonderful that you're doing three screenings, because I know that opening night, it's so popular, and there are always lines waiting to get in. So this is really wonderful to have many extra screenings. And then the next night, Saturday night, and you show several nights each week. So the next night you're showing Darwin's Nightmare, which is... sounds like a really intriguing film, dealing with globalization and the environment, and the introduction of a strange species into Lake Victoria in the 1960s, and you know, some of these things that have been done in the interest of building economic development end up being quite disastrous for the ecology. And so I think that that's going to be quite a fascinating film. And that is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. And it's in the Moriarty Building. And I haven't seen this new auditorium that's been built. It's the new Arts and Humanities Building.
Well, it just came into actual active use this past summer, and I'm only one step ahead of you. I've seen the building, but I haven't been inside, so we're both in for a treat. But I've heard from many of the other members of the committee that helps to organize these things that it's a great leap forward. It's more spacious. It's more attractive. And we were all looking very much forward to it. It has flexibility for those who care about the technical side of things, of being able to present things, whether they're in regular 16-millimeter film, DVD, video. I'm not sure if it's 35.
Probably not 35,
but it covers just about every other form. And so we definitely, this will be another treat for our visitors this year to attend filming in that setting.
Right. And so that that film, Darwin's Nightmare, is in the afternoon at 2 o'clock. And then, 7:30 in the evening, you have a film from Nigeria called Heritage. And again, all of these showings are free and open to the public, which is always a wonderful asset. And then what's coming up the next week? I mean, you've got films on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday every week, and multiple showings each day.
Well, you know, you're mentioning something that's very, very key and that we want to get across to all our listeners, because we won't be able to cover all of the different films that we're going to show on our broadcast, but just to hit some of the highlights. Well, one of the things to note is that films will be shown 3 days a week, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, for the remaining weeks in February and the first week in March, because we try to honor mm-hmm. both Black History Month and also Women's Month. And so the films that we show during that last part of the season, that's in the first week of February, will feature women filmmaker and or topics relative to women's issues in Africa and in the African diaspora. I always like to clarify that term diaspora, because sometimes we talk so much among ourselves, some people don't recognize that what that means is those African descendants in many, many other countries around the world.
Mm-hmm.
But for that second week, we have Tasuma the Fighter, and that will be shown at noon, and Maluala, which will be shown at 1:30, and in the evening, we will show the first time of two showings of The Forgotten Root. Now, this is definitely one of our main features during this season. It's a film by an African-Mexican. His name is Rafael Rebollar Corona, and he's done a trilogy on the African presence in Mexico. And so that film will show on Thursday evening at 7:30 at the PCC Cascade campus. And then it will be repeated on the Saturday, the 11th of February, in the morning at 10 o'clock. Part of the trilogy, the first part of the trilogy is a historical perspective on African presence in Mexico. And then it follows up with another of Mr. Corona's film called From Florida to Coahuila, mm-hmm. where African slaves that escaped slavery and ended up intermarrying with Seminole Indians later migrated to Mexico and set up a series of communities that exist to this day. And that Saturday presentation, we are honored to have Mr. Corona here with us to talk after the film, to give you some ideas and perspectives on his views and how he came to make the film, and a lot of context that people will find very valuable, along with Dr. Maria Veliz, who will also give a presentation and have a discussion. And then following that in the afternoon, there will be a special community conversation. The idea here is kind of reflective of how we do business with this film festival in terms of not only presenting the film, but inviting filmmakers from many of the countries that we can afford to have flown here, as well as local immigrants be a part of the audience for dialogue, discussion. So it's really a rather total event.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting, and I'm hoping to get to that symposium. I think it's a really valuable kind of event for the community. So you then carry on through the next week, and I really want to emphasize to everybody that the evening showings in particular are always followed by a conversation with people who are knowledgeable about the culture and discussing the film. And there are always program notes and information about each of the countries represented. So this is, again, such a wonderful community event that really brings people together, brings the cultural diversity of Portland together in this festival. So this is Brooke Jacobson. I've been talking with Wiley G. Barnett of the African Film Festival Committee. And the African Film Festival begins at Portland Community College. We'll be running at Portland Community College. And I want to mention their website, which is www.africanfilmfestival.org. And it's a wonderful website. Check it out, and it will give you scads of information. Thank you. This is Brooke Jacobson.
And thank you, Brooke. Thank you, Wiley. This is Norm Diamond. I'm looking forward as well to the African Film Festival. It is one of the highlights of each year. And to all of you who have been listening all these many years, I guess I'll say what Mark said. Well grubbed, old mole. Goodbye. Tune in next week.
Mole in the ground. By the mole. mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.